Thank you. Thank you, Tom, and thank you to the Frisch Institute for the invitation. Let me first of all say this is your work with my main two co-authors and great mathematicians and great human beings, Jacques Chirivitanis and Abel Cabanillas. Let me also say about what Tom pointed out, the hotness of the topic. This is actually the paper I'm presenting. A few weeks ago when I told Tom, yeah, I accepted the generous invitation of the Frisch Institute, I was debating what paper to present, and I was thinking about another paper on portfolio allocation, a working paper I have now. Then it hit me that this is an old paper that Jacques, Abel, and I started. This is an area of research we started working on a few years ago. Actually, quite a few years ago, we got a paper published. This was a follow-up. I'll tell you later on a little bit about more the story of the paper. We, for a while, we parked. I'll tell you why. Then I decided that maybe this was an opportunity to first talk about a topic that is not all that standard in mathematical finance, although it's becoming an area where there is more and more research. I thought that, assuming that there will be graduate students, this will provide a feel for a possible area of interest these days, not only in mathematical finance, but in finance and economics in general. Also, it was an opportunity for me to review the paper and then think about what we are going to do with it. I'll give you later on more details of where we stand with the paper and why it's still a working paper that has been sort of stagnant for the last 3 years or so. The area, I mean, this has been an important area of research or debate in finance and economics for the last now many years, I don't know, 15, 20 years, maybe especially in the last 10 years with ups and downs. The reason is that stock options, there are many reasons, but the main reason why people started working on this, again, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, is that stock options are a very important component of executive compensation. That's a fact. In fact, not only executive compensation, but compensation in general. And there was some debate why managers or people below the executive will get options. We're not going to worry about that here. The truth is that for a while, there were strong incentives for firms to give options as part of the compensation. The reason was that options didn't have to be expensed, were not part of the balance sheet. Therefore, firms could give options for free in their earnings. They have. That went away recently, but went away. Still, options are an important component of compensation. So the fact that options, why options are given, options are part of the compensation, why this is the case, why not alternatives, and so on, is still an open question. There is the issue, another related issue, but I'm not going to talk about here today, is another area, it's a direction where I have also done some work, and it's still, I think, an important area of research, is the pricing of these options. Now, there are some rules, relatively clear, but relatively vague at the same time, rules for firms to expense, to account for their options, but there are no good ways to do it. And there's still an ongoing research on coming up with methods that will provide formulas for the firms to price the options. But I'm not going to talk about that here. The question here is why firms are giving options as part of the compensation to executives, as opposed to just cash or other called the stock-based compensation. Why options instead of a stock or restricted stock, which is also part of the compensation package? But why do we give a number of options and not all stock or the other way around? The reasons, what lies behind, at least the explanations in our model, and I think in most of the existing models, come from the nature of options. The nature of options has two properties that are key in the what is going to happen at the end, of what is going to be the decision of the firm and the executive once the options are granted. On one hand, options are riskier because they are convex. anyone who has look at options knows, they have some embedded leverage, so they are much riskier than the stock. So holding options is much riskier than holding the underlying stock. But on the other hand, and I see on the other hand, because there's going to be a trade-off, and I will give you the punchline in a minute. On the other hand, because of that convexity, options also compound the performance. So if we do well with options, we're going to do, if we do well with the firm, with the underlying stock, the payoff in options will be much better than if we just hold the stock. Yeah? Obviously, the same thing happens on the negative side, but I mean, to some extent, but the truth is that they compound the effect of whatever actions, the effect of the actions of the manager on the stock. And these two things go in opposite ways. On one hand, as we're going to model, and I'll give you, I'll go through all the details of the model, but I'm going to give you the punchline now. On one hand, if the executive is risk averse, and we assume that executives are risk averse, which again is consistent with practice, options on one hand are not good. They have a bad component, which is they're risky. If I'm risk averse and I'm given options, well, I'm a little bit more worried that I'm, if I just have a stock, or even more if I just have, if I have cash. But on the other hand, options, at least compared to stock, give me the opportunity to leverage up my performance. If I do well, the effect in options is going to be higher. And this is the trade-off. And that's the trade-off, actually, which is going to lead our results, our conclusions. What is going to happen is that on one hand I am risk averse, on the other hand I like the incentive component of options. If I'm really confident of my abilities, I would like the options. If I'm not that confident of my abilities, I might prefer a stock. Yeah? And that's what is going to drive the results. So basically this is the punchline of our results. If you think that's then intuition is okay, well, thank you very much. We have finished the seminar. This is it. We're going to add a little bit more structure. So you will see how, on, based on this idea, we can, and this is the objective of the paper, analyze why firms will use the options given these incentives versus a stock and for whom. Here, I'm just mentioning some relevant papers or important papers, typically in, at least in finance, papers to reference the relevant literature. And there are a few papers that have already argued in this direction. Okay, Laser argues in favor of shorting, so options are a cheaper way to compensate optimistic employees, the one who thinks I have a higher ability, I'm going to take options because that will compound my ability. And there's some empirical evidence. So these are all famous papers, Ogier and Schaefer, that documents that that is definitely going on reality. I have to mention here, there are two papers related that sort of precede what we develop in this paper. One is this one by Darrow and Stoughton. They are the first ones, I think, in a paper that has been overlooked by the literature, an important paper, that options might be a way of self-selection. So we offer options, and then the good executives will come, and the bad executives will not come. That's an idea, that's a key idea that is behind our paper, our model. Another paper in the same direction, three famous accountants, argue in favor of options, same argument, to attract good new employees. And then the other, the second paper that I say is related to us, is a paper, relatively recent paper, Ariane Bitterndorf. They show that options provide, again, a screening device for firms to sort out the good executives from the bad executives. What happened, and let me then go on my agenda to explain what is the status of the paper. We had already finished our paper when we saw this paper, and we had finished our model. This is a relatively a paper on a relatively simpler setting that we have with less structure. But we saw this paper, we recognized, and then we learned actually about the paper by Darrow and Stoughton. And we recognize, well, given the standards of finance journals today, or top finance journals today, it's not clear we're going to be able to publish our paper in a top finance journal. And then this is where we park our paper, hoping to get some data or empirical tests, and I will tell you more about that towards the end of the presentation, where we could check some of our conclusions. But again, what I'm saying is that our paper is a follow-up, again, with more structure. We have a more sophisticated mathematical model with way more parameters that allows us to advance the idea that options are a good screening device, a way to sort out the good executives from the bad executives. Let me get into our model. Our benchmark is this stock, and our benchmark is a geometric Brownian motion process. And that's the starting point, but we're going to modify to make this model appropriate to deal with possible effects of managerial decisions on the stock dynamics. So this looks like a geometric Brownian motion, but not quite. Here we have a couple of differences. First of all, okay, in the standard geometric Brownian motion process, we have just here a drift, and here we have a volatility, and the sigma and the delta A will be constant. Here we have a few more things. Okay, let me go through them. First of all, A. A stands for action, is the effort of the executive. So the executive works, and the harder the executive works, the higher is A. And that has a positive effect on the dynamics of the stock. The higher is A, the higher will be the expected return in the stock. This A is altered by this delta, which is a key parameter in our model, which is a measure of the quality or the ability of the executive. So higher delta means with the same effort, I have more impact on the dynamics of the stock, on the expected return of the stock. This effort is costly. So I can work and I can change the expected return, the expected price of the stock, but that's not free. That's going to have a cost for me. We'll see the cost in a little bit. In addition, we have a sigma, which in the standard geometric Brownian motion process is a constant, but here is going to be a control. So here, sigma is a choice of the executive. The executive chooses the level of volatility. Volatility here, I'll explain more in a second, is free, it's costless. So I can choose high volatility or low volatility. As we're going to see in the next slide or two, the executive is risk averse. So choosing volatility for me is not completely, I'm not completely happy about having to choose high volatility, because that increases the risk of my possible payoff. I'm going to be paid either stock or options, and the higher the volatility, obviously the higher the volatility of my payoff, and I'm not happy about that. So I don't like volatility. But I'll choose volatility because volatility has a positive effect. And this is the component here. So this is the diffusion component part, but here comes volatility again as part of the drift. So higher volatility here means also higher expected return. So what we have in mind here is, okay, there are many of projects out there, and the riskier projects also in equilibrium, in some equilibrium, according to some notion of equilibrium, the riskier projects will offer higher expected return. And that's what comes here. So this is how the additional risk translates into expected return. There's this alpha parameter that is going to be very important for our conclusions, and it's one of the parameters we're going to study, that measures how risk translates into expected return. Higher alpha means risk is better. The higher the alpha, the better the risk. Here, we claim, I've talked to a number of people and having heard the strong objections, that this alpha could be a proxy for the type of firm that we have. A new firm, relatively new firm, in principle, will have a higher alpha. Think of in finance, we have this established terminology between growth and value firms. And the value firms are the established firms, utilities, have been around for many years. They are gonna, they offer a expected return which is relatively stable. There is not much risk, but there is also not much upside potential. Alpha is low for a value firm, for a utility. On the other hand, we have the high-tech firms, which are relatively new. Chances are that they will go bust, but they also have a lot of growth potential. And being aggressive might be more reasonable than at least for a value firm. For those, alpha would be high. So alpha is going to give us a way to discriminate across firms that we see in the market. Delta, as I said before, is an indicator of the type of the quality of the executive. Let me also say two things, or something else. We can think of delta as pure ability. I mean, someone is smarter or more efficient or more organized, whatever. I mean, is able to translate effort into more impact in the price of the stock, more positive impact, traditional idea of ability. Here, actually, we can interpret delta in a more general way. We can think of delta also as my level of commitment with the firm. As we will see, when we model the executive, instead of writing delta here, we could have put delta in the utility function of the executive as a measure of the cost of the effort. So high delta will be also, or high delta will characterize someone who's going to work, who's willing to work very hard for the firm. I think, for example, and that's going to be important for some of the conclusions later on. Think, for example, of an executive who has been around for many years and has a very good record, and a lot of reputation in the industry. But when this executive signs for the firm, is hired by this firm, this executive has been around for a while and the executive does not have any incentives to work very hard. So this is an executive that is taking the job with the idea in mind that this is going to be a 9-to-5 job, and at 5, I fall and I go home to enjoy family or whatever I like to do after work. That would be a low delta, even if the executive has high ability, but it's not going to translate into a lot for the firm. So that's another possible interpretation of the delta. The executive, this is the stock. The executive is going to get compensation that consists of N options with a strike price K. So there will be, in our model, for technical reasons, we can deal only. I think the conclusions are robust, and hopefully you get from the intuition. But for technical reasons, we're going to deal only with a contract that consists of one type of compensation, either stock or options. So you get N, but it will be options for a stock. Whether it's a stock or options is characterized by the value of K. K is zero, what you get is a stock. If K is positive, it's a call option. As I said, then the executive is risk averse, and the controls of the executives are A, effort, and sigma, the volatility of the stock. And this is the objective of the executive. The executive wants to maximize this utility function, if you want. That is logarithmic. We need that for technical reasons. On the compensation, which is the payoff of the options, again, K could be zero. But it is also part of the objective is the cost, the effort, which again we don't like. And the effort is quadratic, so which means it increases. This is key for our for technical reasons. Again, I think the intuition looks to me more robust than the particular case we're solving, but this is the particular case we can solve technically. One important comment here, as you can see directly from here, the number of options or stock is irrelevant in terms of the incentives. Because here we can take split this into N and the value of the options, so one option or 1,000 options provide the same incentives. However, it's going to be very important for the compensation. So since we'll have to meet some reservation wage for this executive, N is not going to be relevant. And in fact, N is going to be an important parameter when we are trying to sort out the good executives from the bad executives. So again, has no effect in terms of incentives, but will have an effect in terms of who we are able to hire. Okay, I'll talk about the participation constraint in a second. The firm is risk neutral. Okay, so we have the stock, we have the executive, now we have the firm, the third part of our model. The firm is risk neutral. You can think of shareholders. This is standard in this literature. In the principal agent literature, it's standard to assume that the firm or the shareholders are risk neutral, while the executive is risk averse. Why is that? The argument is shareholders can diversify their risk. So, I mean, unless I'm Bill Gates and all my wealth is in Microsoft, or many people might have most of their wealth linked to a given stock, but for the, at least in terms of numbers, most investors will hold a portfolio of stocks, and I'm not completely invested into one stock, so I can diversify across different stocks. That's not the case of the for the executive. The executive gets most of the compensation from this firm and cannot diversify that risk. And that's why, I mean, that's the rationale for people to model shareholders or the firm as risk neutral. You see, it's a linear function, while the investor is risk averse. So the firm or the shareholders care about the value of the stock, expected value of the stock, there's no concavity there, minus the cost of the compensation. And then here we have this lambda parameter here, which is also important for us, which is a measure of the size of the firm. Lambda is high means the value is a short, it's a shortcut to model, to really model the value of the stock minus the compensation, which again is standard in this principal agent literature. So large firm, the cost of paying the compensating the executive obviously is a relatively less important than for a small firm. And lambda is just a quick way to capture that situation. The compensation has to satisfy the participation constraint. What we mean here, sorry, I couldn't scramble as we can to put the slides together and I couldn't move the AR to the left. So the idea here is that the executive has an outside reservation wage. If you don't pay me enough, I'll get a different job. That's R. R stands here for my reservation wage. So the firm, and it's going to be crucial here, it's going to be an important parameter here. The firm then has to choose compensation, and compensation here consists of the number of options and the strike price of the option, but they have to be such that the utility of the executive, subject to maximizing, subject to optimization, meets at least that reservation wage. Obviously, the optimal at the end, the optimal decision for the firm will be to make this an equality, strict equality. This is the objective of the firm. The objective of the firm is going to be to maximize the objective of the firm in the previous slide. Here, the problem. Remember, to maximize this. Sorry. To maximize this, subject to the utility of the executive being larger or at least equal to the reservation wage. In an additional feature of our model, we're going to assume that there are different types of executives. And in practice, there will be people with different deltas. To keep things as simple as possible, we are going to assume that there will be actually two types of delta, two values of delta, high and low. High is higher than low. The firm knows the types, knows the distribution, but doesn't know who the firm is dealing with. And again, this is where the second interpretation of delta was given you before is relevant. You are dealing with this person, you have the data in front of you, you know all the achievements of this person in the past, but you don't know the commitment of this person. Maybe he or she is already over the hump and is not really willing to work as hard as we would like. So the delta is low, even if the beta says this person has high ability. So we are also going to assume that, obviously, consistent to that, with that, high ability executives have a higher reservation wage than the low ability executives. They are more expensive. There are several types of contracts that the firm could offer to the executive. And this is mostly terminology, but this is something, for practical purposes, we're going to focus just on one. But if you get a chance to look at the paper, this is something that, given that we're in a principal agent setting, we'll have to deal with. In practice, I think, in general, I think it's safe to say that when we, the firm, are searching for an executive, we're just going to offer one contract. The idea of a menu of contracts that we have here, where we say, well, we offer these two contracts and you take the one that you want, is not completely realistic in many cases, especially when those contracts reveal what type of executive you are. Because if I tell you, okay, here are these two contracts, you choose the one that you want, but I know that one is the optimal for the good executives, the other one is the optimal for the bad executives, and you point out to the one for the bad executives, I would say, no, I'm sorry, out of the door, next one. So in practice, that might not be realistic, but it's the way the macroeconomics literature deals with optimal contracts, so we had to at least mention it and solve the problem for the menu of contracts. I'm going to say up front, in case you don't have a lot of time at the end with the details, that for the numerical examples that we use, we can find once in a while a menu of contracts as the optimal contract, but it's very hard to construct. So we do, at the end, we do numerical examples, and we had a hard time coming up with, we were able to, but we had a hard time coming up with a menu of contracts as the optimal compensation offered by the firm. But it's a possibility. Many of contracts with no exclusion, again, that's the case I just mentioned. Offer two contracts, I know one is optimal for the high types, the other one is for the low types, and you can be one or the other. And I know that you come in, you take one of them, and you walk out of the door with a contract. Since I don't know who's coming in, I only know the probability there is a high type or low type, that's my expected value from the point of view of the firm. No exclusion. So. Highs will take their optimal contract, lows will take their optimal contract. Can be single contract with no exclusion, where I just offer one contract. And both are going to take it. Only I don't know if I will get lucky and the person walking through the door is high type or low type. And this is why I have uncertainty. There's a probability there is a high type or probability there is a low type. So my expected payoff is the average of those two. Can be that I can offer a contract that I know only the high types will take. Why? What I was saying before, and that's the key. That's the key device of this is actually what we're interested in this paper. I know these are options, and I know that the bad executives will not accept the options because they are too risky for them. We'll see why they are too risky for them. So I know that if I offer this contract and someone accepts the contract, it's a high type. That's single contract with exclusion, and that's what we're interested in. Could be also exclusion with a high type. I offer the cheap contract, and then I know the high types will not take it. We're not going to be interested in those, and the numerical examples will consider this. We're going to rule out these cases. So basically, what we want is to find the maximum of this. This is like, but this is just notation. And can be a single contract or a menu of contracts with exclusion, without exclusion, and so on. We'll have to go through all the possible categories. For practical purposes, we'll have two types of results. And these are the ones we're going to be interested in our numerical examples. Either separating equilibrium, I offer a contract or maybe a menu of contracts and I sort out the types. But again, in practice, we're going to be interested in contracts that sort out the bad type. Or maybe the optimal thing for me is to come up with a pooling equilibrium where I offer a contract and I know that both the high and the low type will take it. Okay? And I don't know who's going to take it. Why do I want to do that? Well, because maybe, and that will be the case in some cases, choosing a contract that sorts out the bad types is very expensive for me. So those are the cases. I know if you are getting, I'll give the intuition in 2 minutes, but if you are getting some of the intuition here, what is going to happen is that I can offer all these contracts, and in some cases I can sort out the bad types, but keep in mind that my objective is maximize expected value of the firm minus compensation. And it might be the case that to sort out the bad types, I have to pay a lot. Or I have to choose a contract that is so bad, even for the good types, that it's very expensive for me. That's the problem. So in some cases, I might decide, okay, tough luck. I will offer this contract, and I hope I get lucky, and the person who takes it is a good type, is a high type. But I don't know. Or maybe, that also is a possibility, the difference between the high types and the low types is so small. That's another possibility. There's not such a big difference that I'm not willing to go through the cost of sorting people out because it's not such a big deal. They're almost the same. That's another example. But we'll be more specific in a few. Solution of the problem. I'm not going to go through the steps because the technology that we use here, although, I mean, not completely standard, is not new. So, in fact, and this is also important to understand what is going on here, solving this is equivalent to solving an optimal portfolio allocation problem that I'm sure some of you, I mean, if you are coming to the seminars, I mean, and Tom does a lot of work on portfolio allocation, I'm sure you've seen, you've heard other papers on portfolio allocation. So one of the standard technologies these days is, I mean, there are two main possibilities, Bellman equation, or Hamilton-Jacobian Bellman equation, dynamic programming, or you use static optimization. This is easy to solve with static optimization. Just using convex duality methods that again are now almost standard in finance, have been around for more than 20 years to solve portfolio allocation problems. But for those we need, and this is a key thing here, we need complete markets. Complete markets means in portfolio allocation that the investor can allocate money across different states any way the investor wants and choose any level of risk. That's exactly what we can do here. If you look at, let me backpedal a little bit. If we go back to the dynamics of the stock, well, maybe this wasn't a good idea. Yeah, if we go back to the dynamics of the stock, you see, and this is, on one hand, it's obviously a technical limitation that allows us tractability, but I think, on the other hand, I don't think it's such a bad assumption, and I think the intuition still will hold for more general cases. But what we have here is, you see, the executive can choose any level of volatility share he wants, as high as he wants, which is good for the firm. And the firm would like the executive to be very aggressive, because the firm is risk neutral, the shareholder is risk neutral. We like the executive to be very aggressive, take a lot of risk. On the other hand, of course, if you choose a very high sigma, things can go really bad. I mean, our brain emotion process here, and things can go down. If I choose a very high sigma, they can go down very fast. Well, but I can apply effort. And here, a peculiarity of our model is the executive can apply effort to any level. So no matter how bad things, and I need that technically, because my utility is logarithmic, so I have infinite marginal utility at zero, so I cannot allow the payoff to be zero. I'll have to make it positive, and I can always do that. I can apply any level of effort that I want, and for sure, I will drive the stock out of zero. But that doesn't mean that I like to apply effort. Effort is very costly, and when it gets high, it gets even more costly. So that's not good to me. But we need technically to allow for the executive to be able to do everything, in theory. That doesn't mean that everything is or anything is optimal. To me, the optimal thing would be to choose a level of volatility, a comfortable level of volatility, and then apply some effort. If I am a bad executive, I'm not that good at applying effort. But since I am risk averse, I don't like a lot of risk. Because if things go bad, then I'll have to work very hard. And I'm not that good at it. If I'm a good executive, I'm willing to take more risk. Risk is good, helps my objectives, increases the expected return, but also obviously has a possible downside. But because I'm a good executive, have high ability, if things go bad, I can work hard and turn things around. And it for me will not be as costly. That's the trade-off between the good and the bad executives. Anyway, so that's the problem that we solve, and I just gave you some of the intuition of the results, because we run out of time. 8 minutes to come up with some conclusions. What is going to happen? What is going to be the optimal effort? Say, given a compensation package, increases with the strike price, and decreases with maturity of the option. If I'm very far to maturity, I will rely more on volatility because I have more time for things to turn around. Obviously, it's a function of type. Higher delta, the better is the effort. Although it changes with respect to the whether we are in the money or not. We are in the money, the high type applies more effort and chooses less volatility. If we are out of the money, it's the other way around because of the reasons that I just gave. And obviously, it's decreasing alpha. Alpha, remember, is the trade-off, is how risk translates into expected return. If alpha is high, it's cheaper to choose risk rather than work. With respect to optimal volatility, sort of the flip side, the higher is alpha, the better is the volatility. The higher is delta also, the higher will be the optimal volatility because, again, I don't mind that much working hard if things go bad. No, that's okay. We'll get to what I think is, from a technical point of view, the most important slide in the paper. As I said, the end is independent of the effort. The end does not affect the incentives, the optimal effort and the optimal volatility, but once we find the optimal effort and the optimal volatility, we need N to meet the reservation wage. Okay? So we can solve everything and solve for the optimal N as a function of the other parameters, and then write, this is the objective of the function only as a function of K and the other parameters, the constant in the model. Okay? And then we represent, we draw this function. Again, this is the objective, this is what the firm is trying to maximize, so the firm will choose the optimal K. There's a formula to get the N once we have the optimal K. A function of R, reservation weights. These are just parameters of the model, functions of the parameters of the model that are in the paper, but I didn't put here. But when we plot this, this is the key, I think it's a nice technical outcome. When we plot this, this is the type of function that we get. So this is the objective function of the firm. Here, this is what the units are relevant, whatever it is, utility of the function minus compensation as a function of the strike price. So this is zero, so this is a stock. Away from zero, these are all options. What you see is that this function, and it's always, I mean, at least for all the parameter values we've looked at, and it's been many, it always has these two local maxima, one at zero, and the other one at some point for a positive strike price. Depending on the parameter values, sometimes this is higher, sometimes this is higher. So as we move the parameter values, this function, this shape changes in a continuous, according to some metric, way, but the optimal value is not going to change in a continuous way. So what is going to happen is that, say here, I don't know, this is a random one, here I think the stock is the optimal contract. Well, as we change things, for example, as we increase delta, what is going to happen is that this peak is shifting up little by little, little by little, little by little. And at some point, for some delta, there will be a jump. It it will turn out, it will shift, and I think we'll move to the right. At some point, what is going to happen is there will be a jump. So we'll have a delta of 3.278. The stock is the optimal compensation. We change delta to 3.279, and the optimal contract is an option with a strike price 107. That, on the other hand, simplifies a lot our problem, because basically we're going to have to look at these points. Here, this is just a table that makes the point I just made. It's an example. You see here, going from, this is the ability, going from 1 to 2, and here, this line compares with this line, going from 1 to 2, we'll go from a stock to options. And that depends on lambda, depends on alpha. Here is another follow-up of this table for a different lambda, and so on. So here we get of the optimal contract, again, but this is with certainty. We're interested in the case with uncertainty. Of 3 minutes, maybe I'll take one more. Now we don't know what type of executive we have on the other side. Okay. We're going to focus on the following case, which I think for practical reasons is the most interesting. One, high type is better than the low type. Delta H, by definition, is higher than delta L. But also, the reservation of the high type is higher than the reservation of the low type. And also, the optimal contract with perfect information is more expensive. So this is higher than this. Also, the optimal contract with perfect information involves more shares for the high type than for the low type. Well, there are several candidates for solution. I'm out of time, so anyway, this is just for completeness. Let me point, we're going to focus here on the two main cases, which are pooling equilibrium. We offer, what is important in these cases is that we are considering always, in these examples, cases for which the first best is a stock. So if I know what type you are, I will offer you stock, whether you are the high type or the low type. There will be an optimal contract for the high type, an optimal contract for the low type. For both, the optimal contract with perfect information is a stock, in both cases. But now I have uncertainty, so that might not be the case anymore. What is going to happen, let me skip this and tell you words. What is going to happen is, maybe it's what I was telling before, the example I was giving before. Maybe, for me, the optimal thing will be to say, well, there isn't that much difference between high types and low types. That's okay, let me offer the first best, so it will be the optimal contract for the high types. And it might be the case that a low type takes it, but the difference is not that high, so the cost is not that big. But maybe, let me give you another example, another possible case. Maybe what will happen is that maybe there's a big difference between the high type and the low type. And it will be really bad if I get a low type here. Then, what can I do? Well, one possibility is, let me try to find a contract that excludes the low type. How am I going to do that? I will go to that picture that I had before. I'll go to this picture and then check all the possible scenarios. Check, okay, let me look at the options here. Let me see where can I get. This is the value function for the curve. Let me see where can I get here that excludes the low type. And let me compare that with a pooling equilibrium. Or maybe even with a many of contracts, where I offer the low type its contract, its optimal contract. But maybe let's see, maybe this point, this is not the optimal. With full information, this is the optimal contract. But maybe by selecting this, which is worse for the firm, but maybe I can sort out, I can screen out the low types, because this contract, the low types will not take it, will not meet the reservation wage, given their ability. In that case, I will do something that is costly, but allows me to screen out the load types, and it's the optimal thing for me to do. So then at the end, sorry, I'm out of time, I only need 1 minute. Then what we do at the end is we go through all these possible combinations and we find, and we have here tables where we do that, and then I'll show the results, which are the conclusions. We do tables where we look at all the possible combinations, all menus, pooling equilibrium, separating equilibrium with exclusion. The easier ones to find are pooling equilibrium, I offer a stock, if a bad guy takes it, too bad, but it's not such a big deal, or separating equilibrium, like here, where I choose, in this case, this is first best for high tide, first best for low tide, same thing here, in this case, pooling, so offering the optimal contract for the high tide is the best thing to do for the firm. After looking at that graph and comparing all the possible contracts and averaging, in this case we only have two possible types, so that's easy to do. We decide, okay, the pooling contract is the best. If I get a bad type, too bad. But here, and you see here the difference, we have a few tables at the end of the paper, and we'll go through many of these cases. This is just a sample. I will give you now a summary of the results. Here you see the only difference between these two cases is that the difference between the high and the low type is bigger. So in this case, I have a stronger incentives to sort out, to screen out the bad types. And sure enough, in this case, the optimal thing for me to do is to give options. The optimal contract is options. And this is it's a separating equilibrium, which means, in this case, I'm going to screen out the bad types. Okay, so what we have here is because we have a fairly developed structure in our model, now we can conclude by doing numerical exercises, which are trivial. I mean, once we have everything, all of this in Mathematica, and we plot the pictures, that's easy to do, then we can study how screening using options as a screening out mechanism depends on the parameters of the model. So when is a firm more likely to use options as for screening out? And these are the conclusions. The higher is the dispersion, that's the example in the previous table. The higher the difference between the bigger the difference between the high type and the low type, the more likely it is that I will use options to screen out good types and bad types. And I will offer options, although the first best contract is a stock for everybody. But I will use options to screen out the bad types. The lower the trade-off between risk and return alpha. If alpha, which is how risk translates into expected return, is very high, firms don't have incentives to give options because options will make the executives a little bit more conservative, less aggressive. And we want them to be very aggressive, especially if alpha is high. This is counterfactual. There is evidence, strong empirical evidence, that the growth firms I was talking about before, which are the ones with a high alpha, give more options than the value firms. There are papers on that in top journals, documenting that. Well, why is that? I'll give you my story in a second. The larger is the firm. The larger is the firm, the lower is the cost of compensation. So if I have to incur an extra cost to screen out the bad types, this is still relatively small. So if I'm a large firm, I'm more likely to use options to screen out the bad executives. This is in principle counterfactual, but this is the end of the story of the paper. With this, I will conclude the seminar. Sorry for going a little bit over time. We wanted data because my conjecture here is that it is true that growth firms give more options than value firms. That's a fact. Is that irrational from the point of view of the firms, or we are missing something really big in the model? Well, there is also a potential explanation here, which is the dispersion of types. I think there is also evidence, and that's where we started working with data with a student, but she graduated and left, and we got stuck there, and this is why the paper is where it is. I think there is evidence, at least people I have talked to, there's also some anecdotal evidence that in growth firms, the dispersion of types is probably bigger. Why is that? The standard growth firm is a high-tech firm, so it's a startup company by a dropout computer science MIT major or Stanford major, who starts the firm does pretty well, and at some point the firm goes public, and then there's a choice of a CEO. Well, the guys who started the firm are the candidates to be the CEOs, but they are great engineers, really smart, creative people, but we don't know how good executives they will be. One possible way to make sure that they are going to at least kill themselves for the firm is we give them options. Those effects go in opposite directions. The dispersion is an incentive to give more options. The high alpha is an incentive to give a stock. But maybe what is happening is that those cases, the former is more important than the latter. And that's where we are. We would like to get data. I mean, we know where to get the data. We just have to process it. Well, we can document that for high tech, for growth firms, the dispersion of types is bigger. How can we document that? Well, CEOs are typically younger, which means you have less information. So the volatility of the prior on the ability of the executive is higher. Okay, sorry for going over time. Thank you very much.